What's that place you've always wanted to try?
Well, you're there, sharing plates with
just one bite.
Or on second thought,
maybe not sharing. It's that good.
When you're with Amex, it's not if it's going to happen, but when. American Express. Don't live life without it.
Hello, and welcome to episode 153 of
Podaroonie, mate.
I won't keep you long on this introduction because I'm recording this on my phone because I'm in a house in Portugal, house sitting, looking after someone's house and pets. I'll tell you all about that later. But this episode is a chat with Guy Pratt, who is a brilliant bass player who's played with Pink Floyd and Michael Jackson and Madonna, Brian Ferry, and many others. But he's also a stand-up comedian, a renowned stand-up comedian who's played all over the world. And that's what we'll be talking about in this episode. And he's been put in contact with me by Ellen O'Reilly, who's also a brilliant bass player and a stand-up comedian. And Ellen is playing in a musical that's called Operation Mincemeat. And it's in the Southwark Playhouse in London, if you want to check it out. And that's what we start this conversation talking about, myself and Guy Pratt.
So the show was really good, isn't it?
It's absolutely brilliant. It's what's interesting is it's the first thing I've seen which shows that we really are in the post-Hamilton world, in that it's that same, it uses all the same sort of tricks that Hamilton does.
And oh, also, really?
Yeah, well, the fact that actually, because rap is the best thing that ever happened to musicals, because it's the most efficient dialogue delivery system ever invented. You can get so much said, really understandably, you know, because I love musicals, but I hate recitative, which is the thing when they're kind of, singing but not really singing to anything. And then I opened the window and she was standing outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is horrible. Whereas if you rap something, it's great, you know.
Right, yeah. So, you could probably even, probably do exposition. Exposition's probably the hardest.
Exposition stuff, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So listen, Guy, obviously you've done lots of work with Pink Floyd, Brian Ferry, Robert Palmer, loads of people, Madonna, Michael Jackson, and there's loads of amazing stories in your book, My Bass and Other Animals. But that book came from doing a show, so like a stand-up show where you told these stories.
Yes, it did. I did it for, I've done various shows for, my first run at Edinburgh was in 2005. And then my sixth and final run at Edinburgh was in 2017. And since then, I went around the world. I went to Australia 3 times. I went to New Zealand once. Went all over Europe. I've done 2 shows in America. It was brilliant. And so completely different to my life as a musician because I was standing up on my own in front of people every night who didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what they were going to think. They didn't know what they were going to get. And, 99 times out of 100, it worked. I only had a couple of really disastrous fails. And it's really interesting, the difference between comedy and music, in that, A, it's so satisfying there's nothing more gratifying than a laugh. And it's immediate. You don't have to wait till the end of the song. And it's only you they're laughing at. No one else. You don't share it with anyone. And it's also terrifying in a way that playing music isn't.
Yes, because I do stand up, and
I've
been in a band up till I was 25. I was in a band, and then I went to do comedy. Now I was in a double act to start off with.
That must help a lot. That must help a lot, or does it? Or does it just give you something else to worry about?
Safer. It's a little bit safer. It's like, coming from the band into double act wasn't quite as scary. It was still scary for me to do stand-up because basically if you don't get a laugh, it's awful.
It's the worst. Well, yeah, a minute without a laugh is like a year. Isn't it? You start seeing tumbleweeds and kind of but what, so what made you want to do that? What, if you were playing, was music what you wanted to do?
Well, it kind of was. I kind of fell into it. I was asked to be the singer in a band because of how I looked rather than any singing skills. Now, it turns out I could sing fairly good, fairly well. But then it became, you know, what I wanted to do, but it didn't work out. And a friend that I hung around with all the time was really into comedy. And comedy wasn't seen as a career move back then, actually. When I was 25, that's a long time ago. It was when the alternative scene was starting. So I started in the same club as Ardlahanlan, Dylan Moran, as you call him.
Oh, right. What do you call him?
Dylan Moran. That's the way you pronounce the name.
Oh, right. Because it's funny you say that it was a different career. Because what's interesting is like when a friend of mine put this beautifully, it's because when I was a kid, like in the 70s, before the whole alternative thing had started, and basically before the America, it was Americans who made stand-up cool. I mean, stand-up was always cool in America. But basically, as a career choice, stand-up comedian was sort of next to tramp, essentially, in terms of social standing, wasn't it? It was just racist bloke in a northern club. Going, you know, my wife's so fat, she wears Chanel fat bastard, you know.
Yeah. I didn't even understand how took a friend of mine to say we could do this. And to be honest, we didn't know there was any clubs around, so we would ask bands, could we open for them? And we were a bit wacky, like, you know, we wore wigs and did ridiculous stuff. But
yeah, but mate, if you're trying to sell wacky, we wore wigs isn't really cutting it. You must have something. We were so wacky, we wore wigs, almost as if it was almost as if it was show business or something.
I tell you what, we were loud and a bit like Young Ones style.
The Dangerous Brothers.
We were in your face.
Was it that sort
loud
of?
And and we were also opening for bands, so there's no way we could have been in any way subtle. Have you ever done comedy where there's also music? Bands on.
Do you know what? Okay, one of the worst things I ever had was when I hadn't been doing it for long, and I'd started the year before, and then David Gilmour made an album, and we were going out on the road, and to launch it, he had this album launch party, which was also his birthday party. It was his 60th birthday party at the Porchester Hall, and was Jules Holland playing? There was all sorts of amazing people playing as well, and us. And David asked me if I'd do like a tight 10 before we went on and played. I went, yeah, sure, that'd be fantastic. But I'll write something specially for it, just about David. But of course, I then suddenly realized that I play sober, but I have to have a drink to do stand up. I absolutely did it. So I was like, fuck. So I've somehow got to get myself pissed enough to be able to get up and do the comedy, but then be sobered up immediately afterwards. And I worked myself into a terrible state. So the funny thing is, I can't remember. I tried to write something funny about, but obviously not too disrespectful about David. And at the end of the gig, Nick Mason came up to me and said, "That was so sycophantic. I want to book you for my funeral now."
So you were very,
very clearly too respectful.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, but the other one actually, because then it was suggested, because David, just like Pink Floyd, never had a support act on tour, just because there's no room for anyone else on the stage, because there's so many pedals, and just because the show's so long and has an intermission. So, but so it was suggested obviously probably by someone in the sort of account side, that maybe I could be the opening act on tour, because obviously it doesn't cost them anything. But then David made this really good point. He said, absolutely not. I said, why? He said, because when you then come on stage with me, I want people to take you seriously.
No, it just totally would not work.
Yeah.
It would not work. In fact, the band I was in were really serious, and I found that people who knew me from the, how are they going to react?
You know? Yeah.
And anyway, I was going to ask you, so were you really scared? Do you remember your first gig?
Yo, no, I absolutely remember my first gig. It was, because I had the idea, there's a good friend of mine, Steve First, has this character, Lenny Bay. She's, you know, very well-known writer, brilliant character. And it was him who first persuaded me. He said, I think you should try doing a stand-up type thing. And because sort of, predictably being liberal metropolitan elite that I am, I'm a member of the Groucho Club. And so the Groucho Club has this thing where they have club dinners, which is where someone gets up and talks about, you know, you have dinner and then someone gets up and talks about something, which is, you know, usually their new cookery book, which you've just seen. But I thought, I know, I'll do a Groucho dinner because at least it's a safe audience. So I just wrote some notes and I got a bass out because the whole thing of my show is I play bass. Scribbled down some stories and everything, booked this dinner and it sold out. I was like, oh my God, fuck. And then the thing is I got up after dinner to tell these stories and I looked around the room and half the people I was telling stories about were there. Right. It's like, fuck, can't do that one. Can't do that one. Can't do that. And then I actually thought, actually, you know what? If you can't say it in front of them, you shouldn't be saying it in front of strangers. So I told her, and it's, you know, the old Oscar Wilde is so true. You know, there's only one thing worse than being talked about and that's not being talked about. Because no one's seen, you know, everyone loved it. Everyone loves having a bit of fun poked at them as long as it's nice. Because the whole thing with my act has always been the only person who really comes out of it looking like a dick is me. You know, I think that's kind of the key to it. Because musicians always take themselves so seriously. And it so happens that someone was there. Someone had been sent by John Pidgeon from Radio 2 to see if I was funny. And they reported back and said, yeah, you know what, he is funny. So I then got asked to be a guest on this brilliant radio show they used to be called Jamming that Roland Rivron did, where he played drums and there'd be two musical guests and two comedy guests. And so I got asked to go on that as musical guest. And the comedy guest that week was Kate Robbins, right? The brilliant, the queen of voiceovers, amazing actress and everything. And she said, you're really funny. You should do an Edinburgh show. And I went, well, yeah, I'd love to do that. So she offered to direct me. So, I mean, this whole thing just snowballed really quickly. And so then I used to go up to her place outside London and rehearse in this little village hall. And she found me an agent. And then I was in Edinburgh within 3-4 months.
And you did...
Doing the whole month.
What
I did the
was
whole
that?
Month. That was 2005.
2005, you did the whole run, and that was like...
The whole run. It's unbelievable. You've done Edinburgh, right?
I've done... more recently, 2 years ago, I did the full run. And the year before. It is quite amazing. I know Americans find it just ridiculous that you do 28 gigs in a row. And other... Did you do guest spots as well?
Oh, no, but of course, that's the... I mean, the thing that was being a musician, right, is that I got to really jump the queue on a lot of stuff. Yeah. And also there's the thing that 9 out of 10 comedians, it would appear, yourself included, are failed musicians. Sorry, but you know, that's true. Everyone from Bill Bailey to, you know, Tim Minchin to ever, you know, and so I was really embraced by, it was really, really lovely. Everyone was so warm and supportive. And I got asked to get, because everyone has those little shows. I used to go and play bass along to Robin Ince's book show and, all sorts of late night things. And then there's all the chat shows and, I couldn't believe I'd never been. It was one of those things of every year, my whole life, I'd said, oh, I really, really must go to Edinburgh. But then you don't also, because it's August, so you tend to be away. And, and ever since then, I've just been this absolute Edinburgh zealot. Just this, you know, trying to tell it, because it is the best thing in the world. It's like one of the most beautiful cities in the world just becomes transformed into this playground for a month.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the safest, silliest place on earth. And you can go, and what's great is that, because everything's an hour, you're not actually having to commit to anything.
Yeah.
It's not like going to see Titanic or something, where you think that's 4 hours, I'm not getting back. And it's I just had the absolute time of my life. The funniest thing is, of course, I had one day off, right? I only had one day off the whole time. And of course, there's all the people you meet in the various sort of artist bars. And there's all these people who are on at the same time as you. And you go, oh, no, I'll come. Oh, no, I'm going to come. And it comes to you on my day off. And it comes to your day off. And there's these 10 acts. You have to do this loyalty test. So I freaked out and just went on a sightseeing tour of the Highlands instead.
On your day off? Yeah, of course. On my day off.
Yeah.
Back in a small little room watching someone else, I guess.
But the annoying thing, you get that thing of like you go to an event and there's all these other people like, who's like Russell Howard. He started the year I did in a smaller room than me. you know. And then the funniest thing is then the award comes along. I don't know what it's called now, but then it was the Perrier. And to be honest, I was being a really good student. I was busting my ass. I was going to see 6-7 shows a day. Mainly, you know, just comedy. I was, you know, cause people kept asking me about, you know, so what music have you seen? Fuck music.
Yeah.
And it, you know, do that anytime. So I was really busting. You're busting balls, going to see everything. And every day I said, oh, have you seen so-and-so? Oh my God. No, I don't know that. I have to go and see that. And then they announced the Perrier Award winner and you're like, who?
Yeah. You thought you saw everybody in the
Yeah. I'd never even heard of them.
Yeah. I don't know how long ago I was there doing a play. I was in a theater version of The Shawshank Redemption. And,
when was that?
I'd say it was about 8 years ago. No, more.
I remember that. I think I might have been there.
But that year Rick Wakeman did a show as well.
That's right. Yes.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that. No,
I brought one of the cast was a friend of Rick Wakeman, so he got me tickets or whatever, and I went and I brought my kid. My kids were with me at that Edinburgh, and they were like 10 and 12 or something. And I thought, well, Rick Wakeman, that should be okay. And he was filthy. Like I was like sitting there with my daughter, and he's like talking about the reason he played piano was because when he was at school, the piano teacher had huge tits. And I was like, oh, okay.
I've got one like that the other way around. Right, this is where what made me. And it's great. I've never told this story to outside of a bar before. Yeah. Right. When I'd been there for a couple of weeks, and like I said, and I got on, I was sort of was making. I was loving and hanging out with all these comedians, maybe, and I got invited to. There was a screening of this film called The Aristocrats. Has to be pronounced like that.
Yeah.
Now, do you know about The Aristocrats?
I know which is about this, the story.
Right. Which shall I explain for the audience?
Yes.
Which is, The Aristocrats is this joke that comedians tell each other. And it's the point of it is not the joke. The point is how far can you go with the joke? It's got a beginning and an end. Which is basically, the beginning is guy walks into some New York agent's office, goes, I've got this great act. It's a family. And they go, really? What do they do? Well, first the dad comes on and he ice skates and then mum comes on. And then the trick is you then introduce the various members of the family and just see how revolting and disgusting and awful you can make this story and how long you can go for.
Yeah.
People have been known to do it for like 3-4 hours. And at the end of it, apparently the whole point is the agent sitting there in shock goes, oh my God. And what are they called? The Aristocrats! Yeah. Ta-da! And that's the point of it. And so someone made a film where they literally interviewed practically all the big comedians in the world. And they got me and they got everyone. And the whole film was just people just talking about this joke, their experiences of this joke. So I got invited to a screening of this film. And of course, it was the weekend my mum was up. Right. So, and I was sort of like, oh my, I look so cool. Hey mum, we've been invited to this screening on right. And I think we shared a cab with Katie Capstick, whatever, you know, the cool reviewer. It was like, I was so Mr. Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I mean, watch this film. And look, my mum, you know, is from Showbiz. She used to do wardrobe and make costumes for bands when I was a kid, right? Mm. She's as liberal as you can be.
Right.
But she's still my mum.
Yeah.
And this movie is just so relentlessly vile and rude and awful. And after about 15 minutes of it, I just felt like I was 10 years old and she'd caught me with a porn mag. You know, and I was just sitting there next to her, just wanting to die. And for the next week, finally got around, it was clearly realised how awful this film was, because every time I was introduced to someone, I remember, in fact, Dara O'Brien himself said, oh, this is Guy Pratt, and people are going, you're the bloke who took his mum to the Aristocrats.
The story got around. Oh, that must have been excruciating.
It was so excruciating. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that situation with my daughter a few times. I put on the film Betty Blue, which I thought, I'd forgotten how it opened. I went, oh, there's an old film from the 80s. Do you remember that film, Betty Blue?
Yeah.
The first scene is them just shagging for about 10 minutes, it seems. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I've got another one like that. It's slightly different, which is, this was about 2014, 2013. I was doing Edinburgh, I was at the Underbelly? I can't remember, one of the ones on the square. And I have this sort of ritual, which is that 10 minutes before the show, I'm a furious pacer. Do you pace before the show?
Yeah.
I'm a terrible, terrible pacer. And obviously, since you can't smoke inside, so what I usually do is have a shot of tequila, and then I just go outside and then chain smoke three or four cigarettes while pacing furiously around the square, right, before I went on. And I was doing that one day, and suddenly, this big booming voice goes, Guy Pratt! I expect you to remember me, but I'm coming to see your show! And I immediately was 11 years old and had done something wrong. Yes, sir, Mr. Shepherd, sir. Sorry, sir. Yes, sir. It was my fucking English teacher. Right, my English teacher and housemaster from when I was at school. And, you know, who was the one cool teacher? Him and the art teacher. He was the one guy who was really cool at my school, you know, who I remembered really fondly. And he was coming to see my show. And the funny thing is, right, in fact, it was my English teacher. I suddenly realised that my show has one absolutely essential, very judicious and timely use of the word, I don't know if I can say it on here, cunt. I don't know, do you have to beep that?
That's fine.
All right, and it applies to me, so that's fine.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, suddenly, knowing my English teacher, I've never been so conscious of the fact that that word is in my show.
Yeah.
And all I did that thing. I knew the show so well by then that I'm doing the whole show while just thinking, in 8 minutes' time, you're going to say cunt in front of Mr. Shepherd. And then it was like, in 4 minutes' time, you're going to say the word cunt in front of Mr. Shepherd. And then it gets to that point. And I say, you know, because it's about how, what a wanker you become on tour because everything's done for you.
Yeah.
And I describe it. And I say, and after 3 weeks of that, you have become a cunt. And it got a big laugh, as it always did.
Yeah.
But then I said, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I feel I do have to pause the show at this point and tell you, that I've never been so conscious of using that word because, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very proud to say that my old English teacher and housemaster, Mr. David Shepherd, is here tonight. Yeah. And there was this sort of weird, slightly confused applause.
Right? Yeah.
You know what to do. And then this big booming voice comes from the back. Shame!
That's fucking brilliant, actually. And absolutely the right thing to do is to call it, do you know what I mean? And say,
yeah. Well, mate, frankly, but the thing with Edinburgh is you're so grateful for anything fresh on you.
Yeah.
To put in the show. Cause there's a thing when you're on tour, you know, you always I always try and say, what's the big local news here?
Mm.
Right. So you can always come out with a gag about something that's happening locally, right? Whereas with Edinburgh, what? I was here yesterday, I was here the day before, I was here the day before.
Also, if you reference that that's happening in the news, you think, every fucking act is talking about this.
Yeah.
You know? And people do go to see 4 or 5 shows a day, and they've probably heard other comedians talk about it. So you don't want to kind of do that, you know? How do you use the bass in the show then, in the comedy show?
It's actually really, really good. It's a great prop. I do a whole thing of showing what a rubbish instrument it is to have in your bedroom when you're 14.
Oh, do you play it without the amp?
I was at an electric guitar. Yeah, well, no, I have an amp, but I play Smoke on the Water on the guitar, yeah. And then play it on the amp, you know, and then just, I mean, it's musical gags are great, you know. I just go through stuff that I played, and then I get to show off a little bit, you know. When I tell my Madonna story, I throw in I play a bit of Like a Prayer to backing track, and then when I do the Michael Jackson story, I throw in Earth Song, you know. So it's a really, really good prop. And the guitar. I play guitar quite a lot as well. So props are always good. Any props.
Oh, and didn't you, you, when you tell the Michael Jackson story, do you do other riffs that you...
Yes, I did. I famously, which probably didn't happen in real life, but it's just such a good obvious gag. Yeah, I do. I think it's workers. Actually, I've got a bass here. I've got a bass plugged in.
Cool. Go.
Luckily for you, I was actually doing a bit of practicing for something before I did this.
Oh, cool.
So I'm very, very, very out of practice. But yeah, but I... the joke was because Michael Jackson was just talking to us through his bodyguard, and we were all supposed to pretend he was. So I just suddenly thought, well, I could play anything. This guy's going to have to say yes or no.
Yeah.
So I said, how about... Oh, shit, I'm on the wrong string. etc. Which, I think, actually... And you think I'd have figured it out after all these years. I still can't remember exactly what bit of music that is. I don't know if it's workers' playtime, or this with mother, I don't know. But yeah.
Sorry. Have you gone down in volume?
Sorry, I turned the wrong one down. Input down.
So did you tour that show then? Did you tour theatres or?
Yeah, theatres, art centres. I had this disastrous thing where, I got, because of my history with Ice House, Australia was always very kind to me.
Right.
I've got my first shows in Australia because the great thing is whenever we're on tour with anyone playing bass, wherever the tour ended, I'd just try and get some gigs there and stay on, do some comedy. And, you know, and occasionally on off day, you have to be very careful about that because people don't really, you know, if I was flying me to Berlin and paying for me to stay in a hotel, I wouldn't be that happy about me then going and playing a comedy club on my, yeah. I did a Brian Ferry tour that ended in Australia.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting a few comedy gigs and then met this really great PR girl, Jane Intini. Then I got asked back to do things. Because the other things I got asked to do, was this, it's quite funny, it opened up this other world to me. Oops, sorry. Opened up this other way, which is where there's all these guitar festivals, these very musician-y guitar festivals, where they invite all the kind of super hot players, and it's basically four guitarists and stuff. And, you know, they'll invite people like Tony Levin, Joe Satriani, people like that. I would never get invited to something like that, obviously, and I have no interest in doing it because it's more clinicky and kind of, you know, for people with super chops.
Yeah.
But suddenly, because I had a comedy show, people didn't quite understand. They thought I did a clinic. So I'd get asked to go and do those things, and that's this whole other world, which is great. So I actually got flown all the way to New Zealand for one of those and ended up just doing my comedy show.
But you do your comedy show in one of these.
Yeah, I just do my comedy show. Yeah, I do it. Yeah, and then I did the London Bass Show. I did the NAMM Show in LA.
Mm. Do you ever think that some people are coming along and they want you to be more of a muso and they're going, oh,
oh
no.
God, yeah. No, I've had that loads. Loads, of course. But, you know, tough. But no, cause it's especially actually in, oh, okay, I'll tell you, here's one. The worst gig I've ever had, which was on paper the best thing ever. Through a friend of mine who has a place in Marrakesh, I met the manager of this incredibly exclusive little hotel. I mean, it didn't have a name on the door or anything. You know, you had to know about it. And I think it was sort of half owned by Richard Branson's sister and everything. Anyway, he was trying to launch it as more of get a sort of cabaret thing happening there. And so he offered to pay, he said, we'll fly you, right, you know, your wife and baby son out. You do two nights here. You can stay for 6 days, total tab, total room service tab, totally everything, and fly back. You know, we won't pay you, but then total tab, which actually on paper works out as possibly more than I've ever been paid for anything in my life, if I rinse the room service, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. So, and I'm thinking, well, there's, you know... I'm thinking, yeah, okay, I've got no idea who's going to come to this thing. But so I got to Marrakesh, all looking good, show's all set up and everything. And then I come down to do the show and it is packed. It's packed. It is heaving. People hanging from the rafters. I'm thinking, this is odd. It's like, I mean, it should be nice, but I don't quite see why this is happening.
Yeah.
So then I start talking, and of course the audience are all French, and realize that I'm talking in English and not just playing music. And one says, "Why do you not play some more Pink Floyd?"
Oh,
I said, "Well,
God.
No, I'm here to do my show." Went, oh, so then they just get on with their meals and talk very loudly.
Oh.
Because it turns out that what happened was the show hadn't been selling very well at all. So the manager puts out this, some sort of, you know, communication, email, text, whatever, to the entire French expat community saying Pink Floyd are playing in my hotel tonight.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh, so, what did you do? Yeah. What did you do?
I just stood there and died on my ass for an hour and a half. And then I had to go back the next night and do exactly the same thing.
You had to do a second one.
Yeah, I had to do the second one and just go. And although I can't remember what happened with the second one, because obviously word got out that Pink Floyd weren't playing.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Oh, I feel your pain. I mean, it's happened to me.
Come on. Let's hear yours. Let's hear. What's your worst?
Well, I've done, first of all, I've had gigs where people were, have you ever done Leighton Live in Edinburgh?
But that yes,
used,
yes,
that, well,
yes.
That used to be, I think it's much nicer now, but, I'm talking about, 20 years ago or something.
Basically, I used to go, well, this is down in the basement of Underbelly, you're talking about.
Yeah, it is now, but it used to be, it's burnt down, there's a gilded balloon that actually was destroyed by a fire. But, it used to be in there, and it was proper theater with, two balconies and then downstairs. And it was just basically three acts and one of them would be absolutely abused. And it just happened that one act would die. And I was in this double act that fucking died. It was like three tiers of people going, "You're fucking shit." In Scottish accents, "You're fucking shite." You know? Screaming at us. And, there was, the other two acts was, one of them was the guy, there was like some freak circus, you know, where people would come out and lift, cement blocks with their testicles or something. And the other guy was a ventriloquist who had a dummy that actually, he would have an argument with the dummy, leave the stage, and then it was turned out he had a fucking remote and the dummy then would start talking.
That's very good.
And, he was.
That sounds very good. That does sound very good.
Yeah, so they weren't going to die. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And, but both of those guys loved the fact that they were like, we came backstage, they were like, "That was fucking awesome, man." They just loved it that we died so badly. And it kind of is brilliant because you never are scared again. You never get scared again.
Yeah. I know it kind of has to happen. Although it's a funny thing, Hick, that some friends of mine made this brilliant documentary called Dying Laughing. Have you seen it? About stand-up, about why. Because the thing with stand-up, when people start, and this applies to kind of to American stand-ups, where they're literally getting on planes and just going to nowhere, where they know no one, to some bullet hole ridden motel on their own, and then going to a club where everyone hates them. And you think, where the difference between that and being in a band, when you start up in a band and it's shit and you've got nothing and you're playing toilets and everything, but you're with your mates.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great. It doesn't matter. You're all facing the adversity together and you can see why you'd put up with that and go through it. But with stand up, you just think, after day three, why would you bother? You know, and the stories in this documentary are fantastic. They talk to everyone. But there's one particular line I love. Someone said, the thing with heckling is, how come heckling is okay? It's like, this is the only place where you're allowed to do that. So can you imagine, what if people heckled TED Talks? You know, what if we could harness the power of the world's oceans to feed the poor? Fuck you, asshole!
Shite! I mean, or theatre, you know, imagine in the middle of a play.
Exactly.
It's fucking shit!
But the good thing with my show actually is because it's so specialist is that I don't really get hecklers. And the ones I do are just clearly mad. They're just clearly properly absolutely mad. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm not very good at dealing with hecklers. Do you? I mean, everyone has their kind of retorts, don't they?
Right, yeah, yeah. But I've had some mad stuff where I used to actually finish my act doing a kind of a river dancey thing. So I'd have a pair of tights on under my trousers and a little...
I did that anyway.
yeah. And yeah, just because I liked it. And a really tight, tiny t-shirt. Like I bought a t-shirt for an eight-year-old, so it was really tight. And on under my shirt, you know. And so I take them off, and then I get a pair of goggles and flippers and do this kind of ridiculous version of river dance. But river dance. But I used to have to make sure I had the right underwear, like that really cupped everything in, you know. And a couple of times I forgot. It was a fucking corporate gig with like in a beautiful, nice Four Seasons hotel, and I was doing my river dance, and my testicles was just hanging out, and I could see these women at the front were just not happy. And I was like, well, what's wrong? And it's just fun. I'm just dancing. But it was because of my testicles. But then,
Right. So you were just like a really rubbish version of puppetry of the penis.
Yeah. penis with a pair of tights over, like a burglar penis. Yeah.
But. Actually, I'll tell you one of the other really awful ones I had was I remember the first time I got asked to be on a charity gig, right? And that's when you think, oh my God, I've made it. I'm on the charity circuit, you know. Hooray. It's the moment where you start getting those gigs where you're not going to get paid. That's when you realize you've made it.
yeah.
They're not paying me anymore. It was a big deal. It was the opening of the brand spanking new, the Amnesty International Centre in London somewhere. I can't remember the fund. And there were all these really cool people on the bill, way above my, you know, I shouldn't really have been there, but it was fantastic. You think, oh my God, this is, and you think, and on paper, whenever they were sorting this out, they go, yeah, no, this is fantastic. The idea is, because you'll have someone from Amnesty International talking about what they do, then they'd have one of their sort of ambassadors, then a comedian, then you'd have another Amnesty International person, then a comedian. Right. So you'd literally have woman would come out and talk about how they burnt down her village in Brazil, kill everyone. Then I have to sort of come on and go, so let me tell you about the time I burnt down the house with Madonna. And
yeah.
And I remember, I can't remember who was on before I came up, but I came out to about sort of 500 people in tears.
And now to lighten things a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, segue that.
Yeah, it's happened. The corporates, fuck. Charity gigs as well, yeah. And you're not even getting paid. Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not getting paid to die. you were talking about, you getting drunk.
Yes.
For doing comedy. And now you're not doing it because you don't drink, right?
No, it's not as simple as that. I'm not doing it because I don't drink. I mean, obviously I wouldn't have been doing it anyway. I mean, you know. Where would I be doing it?
But that is
a major consideration. I haven't done one sober because it's. I'm sure I know I can because obviously you know I'm not drunk doing this. I'd like to think I'm being funny, but I'm not.
Because it's similar to. I know Dylan Moran had this thing because he was. It almost became part of his act that he'd be slightly tipsy. You know.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people. It does. Well, it is. Yeah, it was definitely part of Dylan's thing, and it was. And with me, it was, it's just Pavlovian, isn't it? It's just, I always had a drink to get on stage, so then you think you need one. And I'd drink a bottle of wine throughout the show.
Yeah.
Just because you could, well, because you're kind of burning it off. Anyway, well, you think you are. And the thing, but then it really said, I did this Australian tour, which was just a disaster. It was so well meant and like beautifully put on. And it was kind of based on me getting all this TV coverage that never came. So I was basically booked into, I mean, incredibly grueling. Gigs practically every night. 30 dates, tour of Australia. Theatres. 2,000 seat theatres. And I wasn't aware of that till I got there. And I just thought, the fuck are these people thinking? Where are you going to find 2,000 people in Ballarat?
Right.
Or in Wagga Wagga, you know, to see me. I mean, and it was a disaster. And the thing is, the terrible thing is the audiences themselves were great. Mm. What audiences there were. Mm-hmm. But I'd have like between 80 to 150, 200 people tops in some sort of 1,500, 2,000 seat theatre. Mm-hmm. And that is just so depressing. And it just got to the point where, and I just keep, you know, it was night after night, every night, and I was like, drive hundreds of miles every day. And, you know, because distances in Australia are, I'll never forget once, we did a gig down in, I can't remember the name of the town, but it's way south of Perth, this old whaling town. And I remember I took a picture of the sat-nav because it said we had to go 548 kilometres.
Yeah.
Not to our destination, to the next instruction.
Really?
Which was straight over a roundabout.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was literally nothing for 548 kilometres, just
Holy
straight.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so for that, I was literally, I would drink a bottle of wine before I went on. And I just thought, I'm going to be so humiliated being in this huge space that it's like, I'll just get drunk and amuse myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just I had to be drunk enough that I didn't care there was no one there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know. So it's not like in Edinburgh where it's part of the thing. Although I've never really had that, because the whole thing, when you do Edinburgh, all you're told is, you know, there's going to be that night. There's going to be that night. There's going to be three people in. There's going to be that night. Mm-hmm. And every night you walk out thinking that's going to be the night.
Yeah.
And it kind of never was, you know. Obviously there's a critical mass. As long as you've got 15 people, you're good.
Ah, yeah. I think so.
Actually,
I
less, think less. Five think, good ones. Five good laughers, you know what I mean?
But over the whole of Edinburgh Festival, the average audience apparently is three people. So there are people playing to one.
A lot. Yeah, but that's probably doing a gig in a phone box, you know what I mean? Because they're all, or in a taxi, which, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, have you ever gone to the Free Fringe? I don't know if you've been.
I've done the Free Fringe. It's
oh, you
brilliant.
Did the Free Fringe?
Yeah, you get the, yeah, because you're packed. You're packed every day, and you have the illusion of making money because you have this bucket full of change. And it's so funny, you then spend a month trying to buy everything with change.
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, yeah, if you've got a good show, Free Fringe is brilliant. Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, I know that wasn't the point you were making. Oh, yes.
Well, I went to see a American Korean girl do a show in a room over a nightclub at 1 a.m. And man, it was funny because it was so insane. But there must be loads of shows like that. I mean,
there are. No, I've been to a few where you kind of think, should you be here doing this? I mean, should someone be taking better care of you?
Yeah. And they're the people who are obsessed with them. They come back year after year.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what happens to them. But are you going to come back and do shows? I mean,
the thing is, I need to find, cause yeah, the drinking thing's bollocks. I mean, I'll get over that. Also, you're not really a comedian until you've had to stop drinking, are you? Let's face it, all the great ones.
That's it. Yeah.
But I need a new thing. I need it's that's a because it's a, I just can't tell the Madonna story again or the
like, yeah.
I've changed my show loads of times, but all of the stories come from this particular time period, or there'll be a couple because now it's all so different. You know, there's nothing. Also, I guess as my audience gets older and as I get older, you don't really want to hear rock and roll stories anymore. You want to hear something a bit more, because none of it's really impressive anymore, is it? It just seems incredibly childish. So,
really?
Well, because the thing is, because when I go on tour now, it's so different. It's like, aren't those towels nice? And look at that breakfast buffet and.
That's what excites me.
Yeah. Oh, you know, there's so many machines in the gym.
Sounds great. I think you've already started, you're already writing your next show.
Oh, yes, it could be, yeah. Yeah. But there is the thing about being, you know, the older person touring. I mean, there is some quite funny stuff. I think there's funny stuff to be had out of the Source Full of Secrets, because that's such an interesting dichotomy in that you've got Nick Mason, you know, who's, and he's been amazing. We're playing theatres and we travel on a bus. I mean, he's 76 now. This is the first time he's ever slept on a tour bus in his life. Because they went straight from the transit to the plane.
Really? They were that suddenly successful?
Yeah, pretty much. Or you just didn't really do those sort of tours. What is funny is that, of course, having someone of, you don't think about it, is having someone of Nick's sort of magnitude, is that what you don't realize when you stay at the Four Seasons or the Ritz-Carlton or any of those fancy hotels, what you don't realize, of course, they have all their own security teams and all the security stuff there, because when you're not there, they've got fucking Macron, you know, or Merkel or someone. So they've got shit is taken care of. When you're staying at the DoubleTree by Hilton, right? They haven't got that. And Scott, we've just got Barry, our lovely, brilliant, sweet security guy who's done everything I've ever done with Floyd. And there's just him. And you suddenly realize that, so suddenly you get all these people just booking rooms and wandering around everywhere. And that, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of all these sort of the fans, which is, actually very sweet.
Yeah.
And charming, yeah.
But
I got a bit lost there. I had a more specific point to make. I can't remember what it was. Never mind.
I think it's incredible, though, that you did go from something like as big as Floyd to a room with just you.
That's the funny thing. And that's the thing I really like as well. It's really really good for you. Because I've always liked to do things like that when you're operating at all levels at the same time. In fact, because I was doing, when I started doing it, and I remember doing the rehearsals for David Gilmour's tour, and I would literally be rehearsing all day, then driving up to Birmingham to play an arts centre at night. And so during the day, I've got my own tech. I've got, literally, it's like I can just flick my cigarette and an ashtray will appear beneath it.
Yeah.
You know, and I've got people giving me gear and everything. And then I drive up to Birmingham and I haul my amp up the stairs and I set my gear up and plug everything in, you know. And it was fine. I think it's really good for, I think everyone should be made to do that who gets used to, because it's quite ludicrous the level to which bands expected to be looked after.
Right, so you think it, do you feel, you seem like a really modest guy anyway, but do you feel like it grounded you in some sense?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Also, it's just, also that I got in, you know, from doing stand-up, I reconnected with so many people from my youth and all sorts of people from, and, you know, from my being in music and from school, all sorts of stuff like that, because you're suddenly available. You're suddenly available to everyone. You know, if someone comes to one of the big shows you're at, they don't want to bother someone, or they've got to get through to the tour manager, or they, you know, and also you seem unapproachable. Whereas it was really nice, because, you know, you do your show and then you go to the bar and see who's there and you hang out. And I loved all that. That means so much great other stuff came from doing the comedy. It's a really, really good way of sort of reconnecting with your life. So. You know.
I do actually feel that even the really big comedians when they finish the show, they just walk out through the crowd. A lot of them. It's not like music.
Yeah.
Even like big top guys, because in comedy, you can't just write your album. And then you go and tour it. In comedy, you can't just write your show. You've got to go to the little clubs again and start.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's the thing I love is that if you keep your eye open, is for those couple of months before Edinburgh, you can see anyone in a pub in London.
Yeah.
Trying out their Edinburgh show.
Yeah. I think that is the beauty of comedy, actually. Yeah.
That's why I always thought, this, the worst thing I ever saw at Edinburgh, because the whole thing about Edinburgh, the egalitarianness of it, and how big, you know, you got all sorts of big, you know, Paul Merton and Bill Bailey, people like that are always there doing something weird, whatever. And there was one year I was there, and Ricky Gervais came in at the end and did sort of four nights at the convention centre. And basically shut everyone down, and you just think, don't do that.
Yeah. That's not in the spirit of Edinburgh.
No,
it's not. Another thing that does quite often happen is that somebody becomes famous for something that, and then they think they can do stand-up. And within, it doesn't matter how famous you are, if you're not funny, within 5 minutes the audience is going, it's fucking shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So. But the other interesting thing with stand-up, though, I guess it's kind of similar to music in that after doing my first Edinburgh, I was much better at it. And probably a year after that, I was much better again. Mm. And then I've probably got to a point now where, I just mean technically in terms of how to do a show and, you know, and not being freaked out by stuff. But it's one of those things, and so I now know what to do in terms of that. You know what I mean? I have this technical knowledge. But if anyone asked me what it is, I couldn't tell them.
Right.
You know what I mean? I you know, there's all this stuff I used to do that I don't do, I don't know what it is. It's just one of those weird things where you learn stuff. The thing I love is learning how, because I structured my show where it's set. It's a set number of stories. It's got sound cues and stuff like that. So it's kind of tied to a format. But I realized quite early on that you have to structure it in a certain way because it's that weird thing of how every audience is different. It's just like with music. Every audience is different. And there's this weird sort of Jungian mass subconscious. An audience, for some reason, they're all like this. They're all going to like this. And then the next night, they're all going to like that. And you can't, it's some weird symbiotic thing that happens amongst the audience. And I had it structured. So there's a couple of things where there's one thing I go down. And they love it. Like, for instance, David Coverdale. Will I do my David Coverdale impersonation? And sometimes they go, oh, my God. It's like, fuck, they love this. All right, let's do this. And so then you go down. So you have it structured so you got enough room to go off on a tangent. For a few hours. But the other thing that gets me, I remember I had a couple of gags. I had this one gag, which I thought was the funniest thing I'd ever come up with, right? One of the funniest things I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
And I told it night after night. After night, and it died on its ass.
Yeah.
It's just done. And it was so funny. I was like Principal Skinner. It's not me. It's the children who are wrong.
Yeah.
And yeah, you keep going with it until eventually you just have to go,
just
mate,
have to accept it.
Mate. Yeah. Mate, you know what? Maybe you're not in charge of comedy.
Yeah. I think three goes is enough. If they're not liking it, you're doing something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but there's also that thing of when you realise that people are actually getting a different joke to the one you're telling. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, well, think when you're where you
it's
think,
like, that's not the joke. But it's exactly. We all thought it was.
Yeah. You think the punchline is coming? Why are you laughing now? And it turns out the lead up is actually much funnier than the punchline.
Yeah. I love that thing of the stuff that happens spontaneously, you know, because you realise. But it's you know what it's again it's one of the there's so many parallels with music that I love, which is that if you if you record yourself at the start of a tour and then you record the set at the end of the tour, it'll be infinitely different. It'll be so different, but nothing you'll have noticed. It's just like one night you suddenly went, oh, that's nice in there. And so the next night that's in and then it's, and someone else has had that idea. And by the end of the show, like everything's changed in a way, just from playing it in. And it's really, you know, nothing conscious has happened, but it's changed. It's become this thing that works the show. And and the same thing happens with your show. If you go back and listen to, you know, yourself at the start of the Edinburgh and, you know, it'll be like, there'll be 10 minutes difference in the material.
And that happens
just
in music
from
as well.
Stuff that happened. Yeah. Maybe not as overtly, obviously, you know, the jokes aren't.
Oh, yeah.
You don't write another verse one night.
That would be funny.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, everyone goes, what the fuck, what's he doing?
What's he doing?
Where did that come from?
Yeah. Would you have improvised stuff as well? I mean, I guess if you're playing off the audience as well and that kind of stuff. Sometimes the best stuff comes from something accidentally happens on stage.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I can't think of anything.
And it can, you know, be the opposite, whereas it happens one night accidentally improvised and it really works and you go, wow, that bit's great. But the next night that bit doesn't work because you haven't got the excitement or something.
That's right. And yeah, it's because, and it's, because that's a, because half my gags, a lot of my gags are, it's like, I've just remembered something. I mean, that's what everyone does, isn't it? I mean, Eddie Izzard was always the king of that, wasn't he? When that kind of, this sort of meandering, slightly, like, stuff just off the top of his head, sort of thinking up. And, but the whole thing is the most tightly Swiss engineered machine that, you know, that it's word for word every night, you know.
Absolutely.
That's the skill. But I guess it's the same. It's the same. The whole thing with music is that, it's like there's this thing I have with hotel rooms. There's something about if you ever walk into a hotel room and the maid hasn't been in, right, and the last person's presence is still there, you can never be comfortable in that room. Because there's this lie you tell yourself that when you go into a hotel room, no one else has ever been in there. This is your room. And it's kind of the same with gigs. It's this night is, this is it. It was it's not the same thing they do every night. And I guess, you know, with comedy, that's even harder, even more specific because it's all laughs. And in theory, it's only going to be, so in theory, it'll only work as well as it does once to an audience.
Yeah. Have you played in Dublin?
Yes. I did, yes, I did, I've got a story there. I did the Dublin Comedy Festival. I've done a few shows in Dublin. I love playing in Ireland. I've done the Cork Comedy Festival as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I got asked to do the Dublin Comedy Festival, and what it was, I was on tour with Brian Ferry, and there was this little 3 days off towards the end of it, where we closed the tour playing in this golf club in Portugal, which is this beautiful golf resort. And it was kind of like everyone's reward that they were going to do this gig in Marbella and then fly to Portugal and have 2 days off in this beautiful golf resort and then do a show, come home. I'd been offered a gig in Galway and the Dublin Comedy Festival. And I'd stupidly worked, because I was so keen, I'd worked out that I could, through this incredibly complicated series of flights and stuff, rather than having my lovely 2 days at resort, I could just about make it work, right? So I fly from Marbella to somewhere, then to Galway. I do the festival, have a great time, and then go to Dublin. Now, I was so worried about getting, I had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get the flight back on the day of the show in Faro. So there was a big party. It was the end of the festival. I went, no. I won't even do that. Could you put me, rather than being in the hotel where all the other comedians, all these amazing comedians were staying, I said, no, put me in the airport hotel. Because I'm just going to... So I left. I went, had a few drinks at the bar, went to bed, was so worried about waking up to make my flight that I was awake until 5 o'clock in the morning, whereupon I fell asleep and then woke up at 7:30. And it was like, fuck, that's I've missed the gig. It's like, it was the ultimate, the one thing I've never, for all the fuck-ups in my career, the one thing I've never done, you know, talk about you had one job. I've never missed a gig. And I'd missed a gig. So, but as I'm at the airport hotel, I think, well, I might as well go to the airport, see what there is. So I walk into the airport. And I made this incredible discovery that it's about 80% of all flights from Dublin go to Faro. It seems like that's the only place people go.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's like London, New York, Faro. That's it. And so I managed to find a flight, and I was literally, I remember I just said, I'll pay you cash anything, I'll do anything. And I found this guy, and it was like, do you know what? I don't think it works. I think it gets me, I'll get there about the time the band go on stage, but it's like, fuck it, let's give it a go. So I get it. So I'm then sweating and waiting for hours and hours and hours, waiting at the airport. And I get on the plane, and I look at it, I'm just counting down, and of course, just looking at, you know, we've come from Spain, looking at Spanish time, and it's just like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it because it's a 45-minute drive from the airport. Someone's picking me up, but I'll get there like 5 minutes after we go on stage. It's like, that's it, guy. You've done, you're finished. You're through in this business. That's it. We land at Faro. I'm just like a condemned man. And the pilot goes, well, we're in Faro where it's currently 5 p.m. Went, what? Because of course it's English time.
Right, right. And
I was on Spanish time. I assumed it was the same as Spain. I fucking made it by 5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
But like straight on stage.
Straight on stage. I made it. I did it.
Fucking so brilliant. The relief must have been. I know. Amazing. Yeah.
Well, I remember the class, Andy Newmark was playing drums, was my dear old friend, the legend. And I was in such a state when I walked in. And I remember he looked at me and said, guy, there's no way I can understand what you've been going through, but I can tell it's a lot.
Yeah. That's it, yeah. I had one gig in Cork, in the Cork Opera House, where I was really late because my car broke down. And I arranged that when I came to the stage door, I drove up there, left the car running, someone went out, parked it, and I walked straight on stage. It was quite a good feeling, actually. You're like pumped, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I did. Oh, the worst one I had, I played Coachella with Brian Ferry. And this wasn't my fault. This is the stage manager's fault. But I remember it's like, okay, we're all going to get getting ready to go on stage. It's like, well, obviously I'll have a quick wee before I go on, you know, so I'm of an age now. And so I went and I was in the loo, and then the music changed, and I just suddenly thought, I remember thinking, this has got to be the shittest DJ ever at a festival. He's literally playing our opening song just before we go on. Oh my God! And then of course it's a classic, then of course I couldn't open the door. It was like, literally, it was like a proper nightmare. Actually couldn't get out of the loo and listening to the band playing.
I think the story in the book about you listening.
Oh yeah, that was missing an intro. Yeah, that was with Pink Floyd. I was very, very hungover one night. And I had this, cause I had this lovely cubbyhole at the side of the stage, loads of room, and I was just having a lie down. Because the thing is that, you know, with most Pink Floyd songs, the bass doesn't come in to about the time most songs have finished. You know, you've usually got 3 minutes before you're required to do anything. And this was on The Turning Away, which is a lovely, and it's got the big bass drone, and I was just lying down, and it kind of, I fell into a bit of a reverie. I start listening, and David starts singing, and of course, you know, and David just has the most seductive voice in the world. And I start thinking, oh, this is so beautiful. And then the acoustic comes in here. This is so nice. And then I come in here. Fuck!
Oh my God. But listen, if you want to start off maybe doing a few 15-minute slots, come on over to Ireland. And
okay.
Get you some.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, that's a good idea. Get a tight 10.
What's that again?
Get a tight 10.
Yeah, get that a tight thing, 10. Isn't it?
A tight 10.
But it'd be fucking brilliant to see you. So,
thank you very much.
That's a great invite.
Come over with Alan.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we are coming. We're coming to, the Sources are coming to Dublin next year.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, so come.
Oh, definitely.
I'm inviting you now.
Oh, absolutely. Brilliant. Listen, thanks. It was brilliant chatting to you. And,
that was, yeah, great. I really enjoyed that. That was nice. Yeah. I hope it's of some interest.
Fucking hell, of course it is. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I finished that chat by offering Guy Pratt a 10-minute slot. He offered me a guest list to Saucer Full of Secrets. Much better, I think. Well, that's it from Potteroony this episode, and there'll be another one coming along anon, no doubt. In the meantime, see ya now, mate.
Thank you. Listen, if you're still living with bladder accidents, stop. It's time to get your life back. I was just like you until I found real relief with Axonics therapy. It's not a pill or a pad. It's a clinically proven advanced treatment. Get started at findrealrelief.com. That's findrealrelief.com. Consult a bladder specialist to find out if Axonics is right for you. Results and experiences may vary. For more information about safety and potential risks, go to findrealrelief.com.